Welcome to the RUF SCAD podcast, where we explore the intersection of faith and creativity. Martin, campus minister here. Today, we are with Sam Shearer. Sam, how's it going?
Good. How are you?
Man, I'm doing well. Live from Savannah, Georgia, in Christ the King. Happy to have you here.
It's good to be here.
So we'll do the boring stuff at first. Where are you from? What's your major? How'd you end up at SCAD? All the essential stuff.
All right. Well, I'm a film and TV major. I grew up in Mississippi, and how I ended up at SCAD, well, Mississippi is a very underserved sort of area, and so that was something I was always sort of surrounded with growing up. And despite that, my parents always made sure that me and my sister were, like, doing all these extracurricular things, mm-hmm. as many as we could. They were always signing us up for stuff. So I tried, like, a lot of sports, you know. That wasn't really my sort of thing. I was agile. I wasn't coordinated. That's what we'll say.
Big difference.
But aside from sports, we also tried quite a lot of art-related things. In Mississippi, most arts opportunities are performance art-related.
Mm-hmm.
Mainly just because the state has such a background with music. Mm-hmm. So I was in band and choir and, you know, very music focused for a lot of the time. But there was also, I think, starting in middle school or maybe late elementary school, a summer camp I went to in Canton, Mississippi, which is about a 20-minute drive north of the capital, Jackson. And that is where the very small Mississippi film industry is based.
Right.
Like the Mississippi Film Office is there. And it was this film camp, week-long film camp in the summer, where you start on Monday, you get into a little group. There's about four different groups at the camp of like five people. And each group makes a movie. And you get like a very base idea of the process,
mm-hmm.
pre-production, production, post-production.
Sure, yeah.
And then we would screen them on Saturday to everyone's families. And it was just this awesome thing that I enjoyed, but it was always just sort of at the back of my mind. Like, it was just a thing I went to every summer.
Right.
And what I had in mind sort of for the future was that, like, I wanted to be in a job that would make money. And for a while, I thought I'd be an engineer just because... I think that started when I was younger too, like when we went to Disney World for the first time and I saw like all the rides there and just this meeting of like technical and mm-hmm. creative.
Yeah, right.
Which I think even as a kid fascinated me a lot. And so for a while I was like, I'm going to be an engineer and I'm going to build rides. And I did some engineering stuff in high school and found out that I don't really have the brain for that at all.
In what way? So, like, what happened?
I'm not good at math.
That'll
math
do it.
Has always been my weakest side. And yeah, there were just a lot of things in that class, that engineering program, that I just didn't comprehend, or I didn't enjoy like trying to comprehend it. Mm-hmm. Like, I didn't want to bother.
Yeah.
The motivation wasn't really there, and so over this time, you know, my passion for movies as a hobby had grown and grown and grown, to the point where sort of in high school and during my free time, I was just writing.
Yeah.
Just writing stuff, not even movies necessarily, but like, yeah, I was just, whenever my brain had nothing else to do, I was spinning a tale.
Mm-hmm. So were it fiction or nonfiction or both?
Fiction.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. That sort of slowly took over until I think junior year, I just had this epiphany. And I had like a switch where I was like, you know, I think I'd rather pursue this as a job, this mm-hmm. film side of myself that I yep. enjoy so much. And like roller coasters and theme park rides and stuff, that'll just be a hobby
yeah.
that I enjoy doing.
Right.
Was
there something in particular that like perpetuated that shift?
I think it was just like starting the college search and like realizing mm-hmm. I have to like pick a program to
yeah.
study.
Right.
And I don't really want to study engineering.
Yeah.
And so... Yeah, after a bit of that sort of college searching, it was like, we looked up, okay, what are the best schools for film where there's like a pretty high guarantee of a job getting out of it?
Yeah.
And SCAD was near the top of that list. And we'd come to Savannah before for other circumstances and really liked the city. So I was like, yeah, let's go check that out. And I came and I liked the campus and everything and pretty much just solidified coming here.
And here you are.
Yep.
I've never really thought about that, but there's such a fascinating connection between something like engineering, especially when you frame it in terms of something like roller coaster design or theme park design, where there's this cross-section of really technical skills, but channeled in a very creative, experiential outworking. That, I mean, you could put that same description on writing or film.
Yeah, it's and very much applicable to film as well.
That's right, and I don't think those two would at least for most, would seem to work its way into the same description. But I feel like there's a lot of similarities there, which kind of lends to the idea that creativity is not necessarily just relegated to, like, the, you know, fine arts or whatever we want to call it. That even in technical stuff like that, there's an aspect of engagement and creativity.
And I think that's very present at SCAD as well. Mm-hmm. Like, I didn't even know until I was like halfway through my first fall quarter that there was a theme park design major here.
Right.
And I thought that was like really funny and ironic that I ended up coming to like the one college that does have
just
that,
as you had resigned my young dream career job.
And I was just kind of, oh, that's funny. Oh, well.
All right. So as you gravitated towards film, I mean, you mentioned the film camp that, you know, you went to. It kind of just felt like a summer thing, even though you loved it. Do you remember growing up and like being drawn to film either as a viewer or as someone who was interested in the creative process outside of just the week at camp?
I always enjoyed writing. Even when I was little, I started reading really early. Mm-hmm. Like I read Harry Potter when I was around 4 or 5 or 6, like way too young to really understand what I was actually reading.
Yeah.
And then like Lord of the Rings, I was like 9 or 10 and I was like, this is boring, but it's really important. So I'm going to slog through it.
That's amazing.
And stories. It was just sort of a thing that was introduced to me by both my parents and my older sister. And it was just something that stuck with me. And movies in particular, I never really gravitated to them until sort of like the mid 2010s. I think it was around like 2013, 2014, 2015 when I started paying attention to like, oh, these are like the movies that are winning all the Oscars out this year, or like started learning names of directors and things like that. Yeah, I guess, like, I just started, like, wanting to go to movies more often. Like, I started, you know, every year I would make a countdown video of my 10 favorite movies.
Nice.
I did that for a few years.
Do you still have those? I would love to know what they were.
They're unlisted on YouTube, I think. That was actually some of my earliest editing work, too, which is another formative thing.
Yeah,
because that's what I want to pursue in film is editing. But like, yeah, I think it was just movies were a very gradual sort of intrusion into that already established, like, storytelling thing. I think when I was really little, I thought of the idea of just being a novelist, but you know, it's not exactly
not the most lucrative career
anymore.
Almost like when film became legitimized in your eyes as a method of storytelling.
Yeah.
Like those pieces connected. Mm-hmm. Sure. Was there one, you mentioned like you started to pay attention towards, you know, notable directors or films. Do you remember there being a film or a director or a couple of those that was like a light switch moment?
The first Avengers movie was a big one in 2012. I think that was one of the first movies I saw just to like see the movie, because I'd never seen a Marvel movie before.
Mm-hmm.
And like I think most of the movies I watched before that were like the Harry Potter movies, which I saw because I'd read the books.
Yeah, sure.
But
yeah.
I think the Avengers was just like, this is a thing everyone's talking about, let's go watch it. And like that cultural moment, I think that had an effect on me.
Which is something you kind of get in books, it's way more infrequent. I mean, I can only think of a handful of times where it's felt like a cultural... I mean, Harry Potter was one of them. I guess you could make the case that Twilight was, where it felt like a cultural moment.
Yeah.
In a way that film, because there's a collective aspect to it when you get together. And I feel like something of that, like, definitely brings the storytelling to life in a way that's unique to just that medium.
And, you know, it's, I think, also, like, a book you can just pick up and read at any time.
Yeah.
A movie has a release date where there's build up to it, and then, like, a few weeks of extreme buzz because that's when it's in the theaters and everything, which is a sequence and process of events that I think we should be preserving.
And you don't have to get me started on that.
Yeah,
we can do that.
Hey, if you want to go for it, we don't want to go down that route. We don't need to go down that route.
We could just spend 30 minutes agreeing in a circle.
Yeah. I'm trying to think of like a more, besides like Avengers, like a more, a moment when I noticed like a sort of more auteur side of things.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it might've been, Arrival in 2016.
Yeah. Okay.
That was a big one in which I was very much, I paid attention to like how the story was being told and like a lot of the editing stuff, honestly. Like, I didn't know that I wanted to be an editor yet, but that was what I was paying attention to, like, how the images led into each other, how they matched up with the sounds and the music, and just, like, the structure of how it was told.
I feel like Arrival is a great choice for something like that.
Yeah.
Because it hits so many different cross-sections. I mean, it was a, you know, big theatrical release in a, you know, relatively well-known genre, but it kind of bucked a lot of the conventions. But you also had kind of this different way of storytelling, and the images and the language and communication, and then even the sound and the score. I mean, Johan Johansson at his finest. Like, a cross section of all those things where you start to notice him, but it's still just a great film to go watch. That makes a lot of sense.
It's got like this intentionally subversive structure that sort of takes advantage of the idea that the viewer has watched movies before.
Yes.
And aside from that, it's also got really cool designs and like this, like, I remember seeing the first shot of the ship. It's just this long unbroken take of the helicopter approaching it. And it's just in the distance. And it's so like it reminded me of like being up in an airplane and like seeing, I don't know, like cell towers blinking below me.
Yes.
It had that weird, like, this is really cool, goosebumpy kind of vibe to it.
And it's like it does all that, and then you think, it's kind of like, okay, this is a science fiction movie, so clearly it's going to be about the presence of this, like, spaceship.
Yeah.
And then it's, like, actually almost not even about that at all. Mm-hmm. It's like it is, but it isn't.
Yeah.
So it's recognizing the conventions and then just, like, almost obliterating them in a way where you kind of have to take notice.
Yeah. And I think from that point on, I started thinking, like, I want to make people feel how I felt, you know, like... Maybe, like, not even in a way they can articulate, but just, like, those kinds of moments where...
The goosebump moment.
It reminds you of something, but it also feels like something you've not seen before.
Yeah, that's right. So how did that translate to editing for you?
Honestly, it didn't happen until after I'd already come to SCAD. I came to SCAD knowing that there was a film program, and I wanted to do something in film. And I didn't have enough experience in any particular category to really know what I wanted to pursue yet. And so I was basically just like trusting the college to whittle down my decision.
Yeah.
And it has done that, especially, you know, sophomore year, starting taking more specific film classes, really started to notice what I liked and what I didn't. What I don't like, ironically, I think, is being on set.
Yeah.
Production itself is not enjoyable for me.
And it's like kind of stressful.
It's stressful and very organization based, and there's no real creative flow unless you're a performer.
Yeah.
Everything else is so stop and start that it's not really like, it's not the process. It's not a mindset I came here to be in.
Mm-hmm.
And pre-production writing and stuff like screenwriting is cool, but writing has become such a personal thing for me that it's like, I hate writing to other people's specifications. Yeah. I don't like writing classes. I just want to write to write and like not follow rules, which I completely understand why that doesn't translate well to film, especially like a starting out film student. But it's just like, I have no intention of making that stuff into movies. And so I landed on editing, I think, because in a way it sort of gives you final say over what the story looks like. Getting that last word and not being like, I'm creating this proto thing and then sending it on to someone else. What if they mess it up? Mm-hmm. You don't really have that worry so much.
That's right.
I mean, I think a lot of my favorite moments in movies were created by the editing.
Which is not something that I feel like typically gets mentioned. Because it's like editing is one of the things where, unless you're really looking for it, you kind of only notice it if it's not done well.
Yeah.
Like, if it's done well, it means you're not thinking about it. Well,
knowing when not to cut is also part of it, definitely. Knowing when to hold, that's its own form of editing, I would say. But yeah, I think just like looking back on it, like remembering all the movies I've enjoyed and like specific moments I can pick out, like trying to think of some recent examples. 1917, you know, is edited to be one shot, continuous. But that doesn't mean that, because you also have to factor in the score as well. Editing the score in. And that's something that is still very involved, even though there's, I mean, you could look at the video editing process of that movie as just like, we need to make these like six seamless cuts throughout the 2-hour runtime and that's it. But there's the moment like where he, the main soldier in 1917 who doesn't have the relation. He's not the brother of the guy who's in the platoon they're trying to save. Or not platoon, just unit.
Right.
So he has no personal connection to this mission he's carrying out. And it's that ending bit where they're all about to go over and cross, and he has to run across from the trench to get to the colonel to call off the attack. And it's like, it's impossible. He's going to die. There's no time. He has no connection to this. Mm-hmm. There's no real reason for him, against all logic, to go do it. And then he just stands up and makes the run because it's like the right thing to do.
Yeah.
And like the music swells up. And it's like moments like that where it's like a character making a critical choice, combined with the filmmaking around it, where everything just comes together that I love so much. That's just a recent example.
For sure. I mean, even as you're describing it, it's like, if you've seen that scene, like, I'm envisioning it and hearing it as you're describing, because it was just the connection between theme and form was just so on the same page. It's funny, even like when you were thinking of examples, the first place that I went to is like on the opposite end of the spectrum of that. I thought of Darren Aronofsky, and especially some of his earlier pieces, where like in 1917, you had these longer drawn out shots and knowing like when not to do something, where you're kind of waiting, and then like the climax is when everything comes together. And Aronofsky was like on the totally opposite side of that, where it's like the editing in his films makes you feel anxious because it is so like rapid cut and stark and symmetrical and precise. And it's like, that's reflecting the theme of those films. And you're actually communicating something by how you cut, you know, and how you edit.
Yeah.
It's like, that's a method of storytelling. Like, it's bringing the story to life. And I feel like that can get like tragically underrepresented when we think about storytelling, for sure. I mean, like to your earlier point, like that's a cross section of the technical ability and the creative process. Like you're using the technical components to actually bring somebody into a creative experience in a way that's just like,
I get to sit down at a computer and just like let myself flow.
Yep.
It's still collaborative. You know, you're talking with the director and with sound people and, you know, all kinds of people, but it's like you are left alone to a degree, which I appreciate.
Something to be said for that. I kind of get
good
that.
Balance of being left alone and working with others.
Absolutely. One of the other things that we talk about a lot for those who have listened to the podcast before is this intersection of faith and creativity, that both of these things are important and actually kind of speak to one another. So I'm curious for you. You've been around RUF for, I guess at this point, 2.5-ish years. Tell me a little bit about that, just like your story of faith, whether that was like a pivotal conversion moment or just like moments of growth or someplace where it feels like you've had some kind of pivotal moment. Tell me about that a little bit.
Well, I don't think any of this is going to be a surprise to you. Growing up in Mississippi is to grow up in the faith.
Yeah.
I was going to church since I was an infant, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It was just part of me.
Sure.
So I think a lot of my growth was sort of figuring out what that meant, you know.
Sure.
Because getting exposed to like certain facts and concepts in Christianity when you're so young, you tend to sort of trivialize them or almost like just reduce them to the words that are being said, like Jesus died on the cross for our sins. And because you're young, you don't stop to think what that means. But since it's already in your head at that point, like even like growing up, it may retain that sort of meaningless status unless you sort of step back and have some perspective, which luckily I think I did, or I'm still doing.
Sure.
And I sort of stepped back and analyzed, you know, like why, you know, instead of why would I want to convert to this faith? It's like, why would I want to stay in it?
Yeah.
And for me, it's always been like, well, I want to believe.
Mm-hmm.
I want to believe that we're here for a purpose and that there's something after we die and that, you know, all these things have meaning to them. And sort of doing the right thing, you know, because the sins are all forgiven, and then doing the right thing isn't what gets you saved.
Yeah, sure.
Anymore.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It sort of goes back to what I said about 1917. It's like, because of that, doing the right thing is just doing the right thing because it's the right thing to do. Yeah, because
it's actually good.
Yeah. And that's just been like the most euphoric truth to realize.
Yeah, that's good.
In the past few years.
Man, we could talk for so long just on like the weirdness of cultural Christianity, particularly in the South.
Yeah.
And I'm just thinking about as you're describing that in those formative early years when you can start to actually put thoughts together, but you also don't have enough capacity to really distinguish like layers of significance. Like, I think what I mean by that is, you grow up in a sea of people who kind of all confess, at least on the surface, the same thing. Or at the very least, they do things that suggest it. Like, we go to church and, like, we have this certain way we present ourselves. But that's also happening alongside of so many other routines and traditions and cultural artifacts. Like, you could almost pair that alongside something like college football. And it's like, you can kind of hold them up. And there's, like,
all the same people.
It's all the same people. And it's like, okay, there's these things we subscribe to. And it's at the exclusion of other things. There are things that we do that reflect those. We're going to go to this certain place and do these things together. There are certain people that we do these things with. And it's sort of passed down generationally. And there's things that you don't say. Like all these things. And there's things like you're supposed to wear a certain thing when you go do it. And when you're like 6 or 7, it's kind of hard to parse those differences out. Especially when one of them you're surrounded by like 100,000 other people who seem to be way more excited about that. It's like, yeah, those things can all get conflated together.
Yeah.
It's like you kind of grew up in a sea of it, and maybe you sort of assent to the actual like statements themselves, but at a certain point you realize like, man, what do I actually think about this? Not just as like a belief system, but as like what makes me and who God is and what it means to relate to him. And it's actually hard to do that sometimes in the South.
I think it can be borderline damaging too. Like, not saying that like, oh, we should keep kids from Christianity until they're like 9 or 10 or not. That's not what I'm saying. Just to preface, but, like that moment in which you do sort of become aware of that while there are things that line up between what people say and how they act in the South, there's a lot of dissonance as well.
Right.
And reaching that age where you start to realize that more and more, especially in my circumstances, because a lot of the people there were very uppity and preppy and sending their kids to that private school at the church. And me and my sister, we went to public school. That was something my parents always stressed. Like, they wanted us to know, like, about other types of people and just, you know, always be aware of other cultures and other circumstances of other people around us. And, you know, we act like school integration and segregation was this faraway thing way back in history.
Right.
But it was like two or three generations ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And there are people in the South who still remember.
Yeah.
And those sort of like the sort of like foundations of a lot of that stuff still lingers on.
Sure.
And it, like at that church, it became more and more apparent to me that like they thought certain people were outsiders. And in a way, our family had been categorized as a certain kind of outsider just because we went to public school. And that dissonance, I think, it almost shattered me, like shattered my faith. And for a while, you know, in high school, I did stray pretty far away. And it wasn't really till coming back. And, you know, my sister did RUF at her college. She's 2 years ahead of me, so she'd already been into it for a while. And she suggested I do RUF at SCAD. And it was only, like, then when I, like, realized the positive things that this faith can bring about. But, yeah, I think realizing that, I think a lot of people who grew up in the faith do have that realization, and it can be varying levels of damaging.
Sure.
And I feel very lucky that I found, you know, a place and a system that sort of reaffirms it positively in my mind, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, that's one of the weirdnesses about the South too. And I mean, we like another aspect of the whole cultural Christianity piece is like, I'm with you. There's sort of a conflict because the answer is not like, okay, we want to shield people from hearing this stuff until they're like a certain age. Cause on the one hand, there is a blessing of being able to grow up in a covenant community where you're surrounded by the word and you're surrounded by people. You know, it's the case for all of us, despite our flaws and our inconsistencies, like, do genuinely believe that Jesus is who he says he is. But when that's happening alongside of inconsistencies on a fairly large scale, I mean, like, we can use the example you used of, like, segregation and racism in the South. And it's like those two things are running alongside each other. So there's something that's true about what Christianity is and, I mean, the genuine belief that people have, but it's also running alongside this glaring inconsistency that, you know, any of us would be susceptible to. It's not like we're standing back and saying we're above that. But when you grow up in it, it's like, man, like, how do I make sense of these two things happening alongside of each other? Yeah, it's just like such a challenge to make sense of a dynamic like that. When, like, we think about the first century, really, for the most part, the entire story of Christianity, this is maybe one of, like, three instances that I can think of in the history of 2,000 years of the church where there has been some form of social benefit to being a Christian. And it only happens within a few states, within this one country, in this very particular time. And we've kind of grown accustomed to that, to where you can go 18 plus years and have your faith, at least externally, like, not ever cost you anything. And something about that feels a little contrary to what Jesus is actually saying it means to follow him. So you're faced with all these things in a very peculiar time period in a very particular locale that has a lot of things we want to affirm as good, but a lot of things we also want to say, like, just aren't. And we're products of it, and we're also, like, contributing to it. And it just creates a messy sea to try to figure out what is Christianity and who is Jesus actually. Sometimes stepping out of it is the piece that's necessary to be able to see it. But yeah. So in your time in college, like, it's interesting, that kind of bucks the narrative that we tend to think about is like, you grew up in kind of a culturally conservative area, and then you go to, you know, the kind of quote unquote, like, secular school, and it's going to just obliterate somebody's faith. But you have the sort of anti version of that story. What's been helpful for you just as far as your time at SCAD that's maybe either connected or reconnected aspects of, like, your own convictions of who Jesus is and what it means to follow him?
Well, I think it started, especially freshman year, there was a very clear separation in the way people at RUF acted, the students at RUF acted, and the way just students around campus acted.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I like people around campus. I have some non-SCAD friends, that initial sort of difference that I noticed my freshman year was very apparent. And in RUF, everyone was a lot more welcoming and sort of viewing these things at SCAD that we like are like, we always like joke about, like, you know, pulling all nighters, you know, getting right. super stressed out about work and all this stuff. Just like viewing it with a better perspective, like a healthier perspective in general. Just people at RUF felt more like aware of themselves. They had a stronger sense of self-actualization than, you know, the other people around campus. And were more welcoming on top of that. So I think that was a big thing where I was like, this is a way Christians can be, mm-hmm. you know, this is maybe is the way they should be. Mm-hmm. And I haven't really seen that very much before. So that was definitely a moment.
Yes. It's interesting. Like, I feel like that goes back to the very first thing that you said when you were thinking about the nature of your own belief. Like, I want to believe that the things that I do actually matter and that these things have some sort of significance just beyond like their kind of functional value. And it was almost like when you stepped into RUF, you saw people who've like lived as if that was true. Like, they could be in a system where being busy was normative, but could resist the urge to feel like that was defining, or like you could have a lot to do, but it didn't have to be the most important thing on your plate, which actually meant it was re-energized to be a good thing and to experience some of that. Yeah. It's interesting how rarely like the challenges we come to in Christianity are actually just the dogmatic ones or the intellectual ones. It's like,
yeah,
can we live as if this is actually true, mm-hmm. and can we observe it being true? Man, that's such good stuff. So thinking about your formation as an artist and a creative, especially when we're thinking about things like writing and editing, how do you see those two things overlapping? Like, kind of this growth in faith, but also like this desire to make beautiful or meaningful art. What does that connection look like for you?
Sort of like I was saying earlier, you know, the decision to do the right thing just because it's the right thing to do, not because you're going to get anything out of mm-hmm. it. Moments like that when a character makes sort of these brave moral choices have always been the moments that have stuck with me the mm-hmm. most in movies. Yeah. Like, we're going to watch Over the Garden Wall tonight. And there's a choice at the end of, in the climax of that sort of movie, miniseries, whatever you want to call it, that is very much in that vein, in which, I mean, the main character, he's basically facing down the allegorical equivalent of the devil, mm-hmm. The beast, but that's basically what it is. And he sort of steps back and makes this choice that is like very brave and subversive in this way where it's just like, yeah, you go, man. That was good. I liked that.
Yeah.
And it's always been decisions like that. Like, I think like the entirety of Saving Private Ryan is another one where they're just like going to get this guy because, you know, he lost a lot of family in the war. And like, his mom is like, he's like the last son for his mother because his brothers all died.
Yeah.
And so they're like, we want to get this guy back to his family. And that's why they do everything they do in that movie, which is just crazy.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, they go like way beyond you would expect anyone to be willing to go to do that. And it's like moments like that where it's just, you know, it's not really a mentality we want to fall into often because it's kind of hokey, but it's like, we are sort of soldiers in this ongoing war between forces of good and evil that has started at the beginning of time mm-hmm. and is continuing to eternity. And that's not really something we talk about or think about very often.
Yeah,
but
that's right.
I find it so fascinating.
Yeah.
Because that means that every like choice we make that is moral in our daily lives puts us on a side, however briefly, on one side or the other. And that's like, you know, it's like we are kind of living in a fantasy genre
yeah.
thing almost.
Yeah.
It's like when you sort of awaken to that idea, it makes everything feel so alive, and movies are like a way to sort of just display that on screen in a way that people accept and people understand and they sort of connect with subconsciously. Or like in their heart.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's something I want to capture in the things that I make.
Thanks. Let's just think about, okay, so like, how do we normally define a happy ending? It's not just the actions that characters make, but it's some sort of resolution where things work in their favor. Like, when people talk about an unsatisfying ending, typically it's like, well, I feel like they did all the things they were supposed to or didn't, and like nothing happened. And right. It just felt like this sort of dissolution.
It's not
solution.
Necessarily like, oh, good thing. It's not just, you're not necessarily unhappy because good things didn't happen to the character, but it's like you want the character to receive the effect from their causes.
That's exactly
the proper
right.
effect
yes.
from their causes.
Yep.
Whether they are going down like a dark path, you want them to have comeuppance or like learn some kind of lesson. Or if they're going down a good path, you want them to be rewarded.
Yeah. And it's so interesting because that only, like, that line of thinking only makes sense when we strip back the language that you were talking about of like, no, our actions actually make sense in a cosmic framework, not just in this like world where we've buffered ourselves from external supernatural forces. Like, yes. That's pragmatism, you know? But if what, like, there's something so captivating about what you're saying. I mean, it's like Jesus on the cross in some ways, like, he was not recognized in that moment by anybody around him as doing something good. But it was good because it was good, you know? And right. There's a value for that in the way that we even understand our own morality and the stories that we tell about it is like, it's good because it's good because God has said, and our responses to it and from it might not always one-to-one mirror that. But if we become dissatisfied with that, like, we have grossly missed what, like, true morality actually is. It's not pragmatism. Man, that's so good. It's like that really challenged the idea of what the happy ending actually is.
Yeah.
That's awesome. I love that. I feel like we have to talk Mississippi just for a minute. It would be unfair of us if we didn't with all of the Mississippi fanboyism that seems to perpetuate my life. Mississippi is an interesting place.
It is.
And it's sort of hard to explain it to some people because it's like some of the absolute best parts of the history of our country have come from Mississippi, and it's not even just like separately some of the worst. It's like kind of alongside of.
Yeah, it's all mixed together in this.
Yeah, so it's like you can't really overly glamorize one aspect of that, and it's also a little bit disingenuous to overly demonize, not the actions, but just the place itself. I mean, you think about like, you know, I'm a big proponent that Mississippi is like the definitive birthplace of all American music. Because all of it stems from blues, which, I mean, pretty much every blues musician ever came from Mississippi. And that's like where we get country and Western and rock and jazz.
Elvis was born in Mississippi.
Yeah. And there's like a case we made about Elvis too, of like kind of some of the good and bad as like, he was sort of co-opting a lot of music that, you know, African-American Mississippians had been making long before.
Exactly. Yeah.
And sort of repackaging that as something that was good, but maybe also like a disservice to the sources you got it from. Like, maybe that's the most like epitomization of Mississippi there is. It's like, there's something good here. But it also used, like, at best questionable means to get it there. What was your experience growing up in Mississippi like as a creative? Because it might be worth saying to people who aren't from there, like, that is not a normative thing to grow up as someone who's primarily driven to be creative in Mississippi.
Yeah, I think, well, there is a lot of arts in Mississippi, but it's all very like expressive, performative arts.
Yeah.
Not a lot of creative. Well, there are, you know, some famous novelists like William Faulkner, Eudora Welty, just some examples of Mississippi novelists. Not many filmmakers. I can't really think of a filmmaker.
It's not, yeah, that's right.
But you know, I think very much this the dissonance I was sort of speaking about before, where this environment I was in at my church compared to sort of the environment at my school, it was like two different worlds basically. And my parents were always very encouraging of like wanting to understand others that are different. And sort of picking up on a lot of things. Just like I recognized that I myself had a much better and more privileged life than a lot of people around me. And that very much affected sort of how I approached other people. And I'd like to believe that I'm like down at some point I was at a crossroads and I went down like the more respectable path. I feel like there's an alternate me that's just like a very big redneck or
like, drives the truck.
perhaps has some less than savory opinions on things. Mm-hmm. And I sort of, I'm just so glad that I was able to grow up and see these things, and grow to understand them for what they are and how they came to be, sort of economically, systematically, politically. Mm-hmm. I don't really know if there's a way to, I don't think about it often, like a way to improve Mississippi.
Yeah.
Cause I'm not really the person who would be able to diagnose its problems.
Sure. Yeah.
But I will say that I feel like I did become very aware of the problems, and, I don't want to just write it off. I don't want to be that person who comes to SCAD and completely disconnects from their hometown, their home place. I don't want to disconnect from the place, mm-hmm. even though, you know, it's very bad.
Yeah.
I want to, in some way, somehow help, you know, make it different than how it is. I guess I haven't given up on Mississippi, because I've seen all the different people, all the different kind, like the uppity people and the people who are down. And I've seen a lot of personal kindness on a person to person level, that gives me hope mm-hmm. in a lot of ways. It's sort of like the opposite of the North, where it's like, there's a lot of outward, there's more systematic kindness sort of in the more urban areas of the country, but on a like communicative interpersonal level, it's a lot more cold.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in Mississippi, it's very much the opposite. So it's like, if we just somehow get this system working better,
right,
we'll be perfect. We'll be raring to go.
Solve that one. But it's true. Like, I mean, I'm even just thinking about kind of backtracking a minute ago to just this idea of like a causal morality that everybody sort of get what's, you know, what they were owed. It's like, if you look at Mississippi, that is not how it functions. Like, a lot of the people who have benefited from these systems were the people who were perpetuating the evil in them. And it's like, if we're subscribing to some causal morality that says, like, it's all pragmatic and functional, like, Mississippi will not make sense. But what we can recognize is, like, the objectivity of the badness and the evil. But also, you look at so many of the people who are on the receiving end of that and the responses to it, like, often that was the catalyst for them to respond with resiliency and actually make beautiful and creative things. Because a lot of them, like, it was steeped in a very, I mean, faithful Christian tradition that said, like, this will not have the determining say of what's true. And it's like, there's a pained hope in so much of the art for Mississippi. Because, like, let's be honest, most of it was from people who were on the receiving end of injustice. And it was a lot of Black Americans that were on the receiving end of it. And you, like, I mean, one of the reasons that so much of like the food and writing and music and even in some degrees film resonates with that way is like, you can see it and you can sense it. There's something beautiful about it. And they're being honest about the hope and the lamentations, but it's framed almost exclusively through this lens of hope. Like, those things don't define me and I get the freedom to sort of own them and not let them tell my story, but I get to tell it myself. It's like, maybe that actually represents Mississippi, that you can see that in the artwork, like this duality of the things we don't want to leave behind, but also the things that really were awful that we wished weren't the way they were.
Mm-hmm.
But it's an interesting place. It's weird. There's no like resolution, you know, no. It's like, okay. And then this, and that's just kind of it. It's more observational than that. But man, so can we check out your art anywhere? Anything you're working on coming up that we should keep on the radar?
I have a website, samueldshearer.com. It's kind of not completed or anything. It's in a fragmented state, but it exists, and you can find some of my editing work there, and I think I have a song I composed on there, which is another thing I have dabbled in on occasion.
Composing. You were holding out on us the whole time. But, though I guess you did mention at the beginning that you started with music.
That's like the side hustle.
When writing lets you down.
Yeah. But yeah, there's some like a couple of music videos that I did for SCAD stuff last year on there. I edited those. And yeah, a few things on that website that might be worth checking out. But yeah.
Sam, thanks for joining us, man.
Thanks for having me.
Until next time.